welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. The topic today is semiconductor IP reuse. With me is my podcast partner, Mike Cianfagna. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
Our guest is Simon Rantz of Cleosoft. Simon spent quite a bit of his career with ARM and is now head of marketing for Cleosoft, the leading hardware design data management company. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Mike.
So first, let's get started with how you came to the semiconductor industry.
So I started out my career as an astrophysicist, and I then went on and did my electrical engineering master's, which allowed me to start getting into both FPGA and ASIC designs. And from there, I was actually hired right out of my master's degree with Nortel Networks. And I was helping develop their next generation voice over IP switches at the time. So for me, that got quite exciting because the telecom domain was kind of moving from the old plain old telephone type services to more of an IP packet voice over IP type approach. And I got the fortunate task of being part of some of the best ASIC FPGA design teams with Nortel, doing some of their new voice over IP stuff. So it kind of started from there, and I got hired a couple of years later for a Silicon Valley startup called Caspian Networks at the time. So that allowed me to relocate to Silicon Valley. That got me more immersed in kind of semiconductors and EDA, doing ASICs, FPGAs, even PCB designs as well. And kind of from there, I kind of ventured out more into doing some semiconductor architect type roles and eventually started joining some EDA companies worldwide.
So let's get into the topic. What are the latest trends for IP reuse and what are the pros and cons associated with them?
Well, recently there's been quite an explosive growth in, mobile, the telecommunication markets, as two examples that they've really pushed the semiconductor industry towards kind of an integration of digital, analog, and mixed signal blocks into a single system on chip type solution. The intellectual property reuse, it's emerged as a tool to help lower design costs associated with SoCs, especially these advanced SoCs that we're seeing in some of the mobile type applications. But what this has brought about is the need to get to market sooner. And that's resulted in significant growth in the use of third-party IP. And in turn with that, right, it's led to a growth in the number of IP vendors that we're seeing out there. So there's a good thing and a bad thing about that, right? The good thing is a lot more IP vendors, a lot more third-party IP being made available. But then that also poses the other challenges, how well has this IP been designed, especially if it's a third-party IP vendor who is new, maybe a startup that hasn't gone through all the rigors that some of the bigger companies have gone through to make sure that they've verified the IP. It can be used in multiple applications as they say it can, and things like that, as well as, legal and licensing type terms and agreements. So what this has led to is a big decision at the very beginning of the design as to do we develop our IP? Do we reuse internal IP or do we look for licensing third-party IP? And this is a bit of a different dynamic than, 10, 15, 20 years ago, where the initial starting point was, the architects building the memory map of a system and saying, these are the several pieces of IP that we're going to have in the system. These are going to work together and this is what the result's going to be. And they're doing it in kind of Microsoft Visio. Now there's this big daunting upfront task of finding the right IP, comparing IP to see which one's going to work the best, and then integrating and reusing it, which in itself is a challenge as well.
Tell us more about the challenges of finding the right IP.
Sure. You can kind of imagine that, you know, when you're building these brand new, often large SoC designs that contain, you know, dozens, hundreds perhaps of IP. So you got to find that IP. Is it internal IP? If you haven't got an internal, do you have to go, you know, find third-party IP? All of those type of dynamics. Well, the hardest part is actually, you know, where to start looking. Where do you find that right IP? So, you know, a lot of companies, they may have a lot of IP they've used in a previous design, but they're in silos. They're somewhere on a network drive. You know, team A developed it, but team B has no idea where they can find it, or even that it may even exist. So often enough, especially these days, a lot of companies, the first thing that they're trying to do because of the time to market crunch is they're going and looking for third-party IP. And that can be a positive thing, and it can be a negative thing as well. Positive in as much as, yes, it can help you shrink that you know, time to market design crunch that you've got, because you're just taking IP, you're tweaking it, trying to reuse it. But then it brings a lot of risk as well, because you're not just finding that third-party IP that might work in your design, but you've got to then go through legal and licensing negotiations with that IP vendor. You've never used that IP before. You don't even know if it's going to really work in your end design until further down the road as well. So, you know, finding the right IP for third-party IP becomes almost like a Google search kind of challenge to start. You've got to find out who are the semiconductor IP providers that may have that IP. You kind of then have to do a comparison of, you know, here's the cost, here's the quality of this IP potentially versus, you know, the another version of the IP. And you've got to come to that decision as to, is that IP going to work for us? Is it going to work for us financially? Is it going to have the least risk, the highest quality? And those are the kind of factors that play when trying to find the right IP that's external. Now, when it comes to finding the right IP that may be internal to a company, I mean, just think about, as a good kind of analogy, there's a lot of companies, especially these days, that are made up of a lot of mergers and acquisitions. They have a lot of IP that may have come with company A that merged with company B or was acquired. And often, you know, these IPs, they just exist somewhere within, you know, the company's network structure on a hard drive per se, or even on a server. Nobody else knows where to find that IP to potentially reuse it. So this poses kind of the common problem with finding and reusing even internal IP is most companies don't have a single source to go and find that IP to see, do we even have it inside the company? And you know, the downside to that is, can you imagine just the amount of money lost by these companies who, you know, they may have three or four, even several copies of an IP that may work in the design, but nobody even knew they existed or where to find it. So they went and spent, you know, 6 to 7 figures buying an IP from, you know, ARM or Synopsys or other third-party vendors just to get that IP in-house.
Now, Simon, you talk about challenges. You know, I'd like to focus at one particular challenge. The reality for IP reuse is that most IPs aren't really able to be reused as is, and they require some kind of tweaking or change. How do you deal with that? What considerations need to be taken into account to deal with that challenge, and how big is it?
True. The reality is that anytime you deal with analog, mixed signal, and even some of the digital and high-performance type chips, tweaking is definitely always required. You know, the IP or IP blocks are getting bigger. And, you know, what was a subsystem in the previous design is now an IP in the new one. The whole chip is now, you know, consisting of a lot of what was previous blocks or subsystems. And when you start pulling all of those together on one chip in these newer designs, they create their own set of issues. And that's because, you know, everything is now connected, right? IP is not going to work just as is. So that's a reality I think we've all come to terms with over the last, you know, 20 years. the promise of IP reuse of, you know, just, you know, a drag and drop type approach of, hey, I've got this IP, let's drop it. There you go, bang, it's working great, I've saved time. That's a false reality. The realization is there's always some tweaking that has to be done. Sometimes the tweaking is for differentiation, right? If I'm buying an IP from Synopsys or ARM, for example, and then my competitor is buying perhaps even the same IP to put in their design, the only thing that's going to really tell us apart is the differentiation. And that's also where some of the tweaking comes in as well, right? Is I'm going to add some of our own internal IPs and perhaps an IP subsystem. I want to tweak that and get that integrated with that third-party IP as well. So that's where the tweaking aspect comes into play. Well, then you have the other problem with, okay, well, what happened to the promise of IP reuse? It's supposed to save me time. Well, it still can, but what's been missing is the knowledge base of what type of tweaking has been done to that IP in the past to make it work, especially if it's an in-house based design. It would be great if I'm designing a new chip and I'm reusing an IP that one of my colleagues integrated, reused, or used in the previous version of the design or another chip elsewhere in the company. It'd be great if I could see what type of knowledge did he or she, you know, come up with in terms of how did they have to tweak it to make it work and reuse? How did they go about doing it? What were the problems? What were the lessons learned, right? What came back in verification that meant something else had to be tweaked? If I had that knowledge base to go along with the IP, then I have a better chance of reusing it. And I have a better chance of getting closer to that original IP reuse promise of saving time by reusing as much as I can.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's poke at that a little bit more. What kind of information should be in that design knowledge base? What's actually useful?
Right. One example is, right off the bat, ideally it should be integrated with a bug tracking system, right? So you have to design some sort of knowledge base that's a single source somewhere within the company that becomes a knowledge base. Have it connected and integrated with your bug tracking system so that at least, you know, I can go back as an example, I can go and say, hey, you know, this IP, you know, had these various bugs that we found, and these were how they were resolved. Now, it could be that there were bugs with the IP just as itself standalone, right? But it could be with what we were just talking about, bugs that came about when tweaking it and integrating with other IP or components in the system. So that's one aspect of a good knowledge base, is at least knowing with an IP what are all of the bugs and fixes associated with that IP and how it was integrated into a design. Another thing is the particular information around reusing and integrating that IP quicker, kind of a lessons learned, let's say. These are the type of things that, you know, most engineers, you know, designers or integrators, they figure out lessons learned, but it stays in their head. If at best they captured it in their own personal, you know, notes. What if they captured that information in a knowledge base? I tried to do this with the IP, and guess what? It didn't work out as planned. But this is how I resolved the issue, and this is how I tweaked it to make it work in the system. A lot of the times, it's getting, you know, especially if it comes down to third-party IP, it's how do I get that third-party IP to work with our IP and our subsystem designs? That's very valuable lessons learned on previous designs. So if we can capture that information and share it with our colleagues, then they have a better chance of reusing IP from third-party vendors, for example, and integrating that with their own homegrown IP as well. So that's just one other aspect of it. You can go through, you know, it's almost endless. You can go as far as tracking IP. This helps when finding the right IP. For example, if I find, you know, two or three IPs that might work for me for my design, it'd be great to know where was that IP used previously inside the company. Did this IP get used on two or three or four designs in the past, and how successful was it? That type of information is also valuable. It gives me a little bit better level of comfort if I know version A of an IP was used in six or seven designs, but version B was only used in one and had a lot of bugs and issues associated with it, because I can see that in the knowledge base as well. And then it also comes down to another aspect that proves quite valuable is, you know, running an audit, especially when it comes to third-party IP that you've licensed, right, is where has this IP been used, you know, throughout the company? Which chips has it been used on? Where has it been used? Where in the hierarchy was that IP used? And that can also help me decide, you know, where to place it in my new design, for example, things like that, right? So that allows for some level of auditability as well in the knowledge base. And that really comes into play when you have traceability concerns where you're adhering to standards like ISO 26262 for functional safety applications, or those in the defense aerospace type industry and applications. They have to, as a must, have full IP traceability and audit capabilities for their designs. So having a knowledge base that captures all of that information in one single source allows, you know, anyone inside the company to, you know, make informed decisions going forward as to, you know, will this IP work for me? How will it work? How can I make it work? These are all the type of things that, again, get back to that original promise of making IP truly reusable so that you're saving time and you can spend more time on the other aspects of the design cycle, like verification.
Thank you for that perspective. That makes perfect sense. That's a great discussion. You know, I'd like to back up a little bit. From a big picture point of view, and from your perspective, what are the challenges that semiconductor IP vendors are seeing today? How does the market present new and different kind of challenges for this business?
Yeah, for semiconductor IP vendors, you know, one of their biggest concerns, and always has been, is the legal licensing and copyright concerns. There's no real mechanism with these IPs that allow them to really police the usage. You know, and with EDA tools, for example, right, we have FlexLM licensing and things like that to help us restrict and limit, you know, the term and the usage of our EDA tools. But for IP vendors, you know, there's nothing that really says, time out, your one-year license is expired. And it won't prevent you from using it, you know, beyond that 1 year term. What you won't get is, you know, updates to the IP and stuff like that, but you can still use that IP. That's definitely one of the major concerns that SIP vendors have, is, you know, the promise of, are you really going to use the IP as we've agreed, licensed and defined it legally? Most companies abide by it. But, you know, there's certain folks that, you know, for whatever reason, they do take advantage of it, and they even go as far as copywriting it, but they'll definitely use it beyond their licensing legal terms. Now, if you look at the other aspect of how, you know, semiconductor IP vendors license their IP, it's all over the map as well. Depending on whether a small company, a big company like Arm or Synopsys, you know, some will license it, you know, per use, you know, for a particular SoC project, for example, so they can only use it on one SoC. They can't use it on another one. Some do, you know, a term license, you know, 1 year, 3 year term, and things like that. Well, again, there's no way to police that either. So a lot of it is the honor system for these SIP vendors. And they're just hoping that their licensees abide by it. Now, on the flip side of that coin, this is also a concern for most companies as well, right? Especially the larger companies, they don't want the liability of the licensed IP that they've got from these SIP vendors being used outside of the legal agreements. And I'll give you an example of that. You know, if you're a big global company and you've licensed CPU IP from a vendor, one team in Silicon Valley here in San Jose could be using that IP, and that was the original plan for that, for purchasing or licensing that IP. Well, the terms of the agreement was just for a project, right, for that particular SoC. But what stops somebody, a design team in Austin finding that IP on a server and saying, hey, great, look at this. We've already got this CPU in-house. Let's go use it. None of the legal agreements, licensing agreements, ever reside with the IP. They just don't. They're with the legal teams and on whatever system servers they're using. So there's no way, even internal, for design teams to know, okay, we do have this IP in-house. Can we use it or not? They have no idea. They don't even know who to contact half of the time to find out whether they can use it. So often enough, these IPs just get used. And it becomes a liability for these companies, right? Because if the SIP provider did find out that their CPU got used on more than one design, then it could be a very costly problem. So these are some of the challenges we're seeing, for the semiconductor IP vendors, but also playing their own part back on the companies that license their IP as well.
Okay, hey Simon, let's close this out with a little bit more about ClioSoft and how it plays into IP management and reuse.
Sure, Dan. As many of you know, ClioSoft has primarily been a design data management company with our ClioSoft SOS solution. However, our customers and the market prospects have been asking for something a little bit more recently, and let's say really a layer above the nitty-gritty design data. What I'm talking about here is essentially kind of a metadata layer for IP and design-centric data and the knowledge that goes along with it for IP reuse and IP traceability. So we've been working on a product called ClioSoft Hub that not only works with our SOS solution for the design data management layer, but to bring together really all of the IP and the system design into one hub, essentially, that helps you manage all of the assets across the enterprise for all of your IP and design projects. So, coming back to that one problem of finding the right IP, one thing that Hub provides is a single IP catalog. So you can catalog all of the IP you've got in-house. So that IP can be internal IP. It can also be your licensed third-party IP as well. So it's kind of a one-stop shop for anybody inside of the company to go do a search for an IP. You can put in CPU or put in a UART, for example, for peripheral. And you can see all of the IPs that are available inside the company. If it is a third-party IP, it tells you what the license terms and agreements are so that you don't infringe across any license type agreements. It goes beyond that as well, right? So it allows you then to have the entire knowledge base that goes with all of the IP. So that single knowledge base that we were talking about, it has that as well. So you go to ClioSoft Hub, all of your IP is there to be managed. Potentially, you can find it, you can compare the IPs, you can choose your IP. But then as you go to integrate it and really make it truly, reusable, all of the tweaks you do, everything you do from integrating the IPs together, all of that can be captured as well within this knowledge base. So all of the things that we were talking about, this is what we've been working on with ClioSoft Hub. So it just provides that extra layer, let's say an IP design cockpit on top of what traditionally we've been as a company, as a design data management company. So, to create a real SoC, you've got hardware, software, firmware teams, for example. They often use different design data management systems. Typically, hardware designs for analog mixed signal and digital, they'll typically use our ClioSoft SOS design management tool. Software teams typically use, the ones that are more geared towards software development, like Git, for example, or Subversion. So there, it doesn't matter to ClioSoft Hub. What they're using is the underlying design data management system. That's just where the underlying data sits. Hub allows you to pull it all together into that bigger, higher level perspective of, this is what our SoC looks like. Here's our IPs, here's the design, the subsystems, the connectivity. It's all here in this one tool that allows us to have full visibility and audibility across the entire chip hierarchy.
Great conversation. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Simon, for your time, and thank everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks so much, Dan. Thanks, Mike.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.